I want to start this morning by sharing a couple of quotes with you. One is an ancient quote, and two are from more modern sources. The first quote is from King David. In Psalm 64, I ran across it earlier this week, and he makes this simple statement. The inward thought and the heart of a man are deep. And that word deep is the Hebrew word amok, A-M-O-Q, which means exceedingly mysterious. The inward thought in the heart of man, therefore, is exceedingly mysterious. And then going to a more modern source, Thomas Morris, who is a professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, has made this observation. He says, we are a puzzle to ourselves. The enigmas we face are not just hidden away high in the heavens or buried deep in the cosmic dust. One of the great mysteries is in us. And then many of you know that probably one of my favorite books that I've read, The Question of God by Armand Nicolai. He's a psychiatrist that teaches at Harvard Medical School. He also teaches in the undergraduate school at Harvard, teaches a course comparing the life of C.S. Lewis with Sigmund Freud. And he said that this is what he's noticed in the students and the professors. He said they avoid examining their lives and they do not seem to want to understand themselves. He says they are afraid of what they might discover. And sometimes I wonder if this is true of us as men. Are we afraid to confront the truth about ourselves and about our lives and what goes on in our innermost being? And so this morning, what I want to talk about, and I sent it out in the email, is what is it that men really want? And I thought of those comments by George Gilder when he said, you know, as men, we seem to desire and lust, but know not what for. We're driven. We love to compete. But we don't really know what the prize is. And we spurn growth and we spurn substance in our lives as we chase power and glory. Listen to the words of Alistair McGrath. McGrath's a theologian at Oxford University. And he says this, deep down, many of us long for something that is really worthwhile. We're looking for something that really matters. There seems to be something about human nature that makes it want to long for something life-changing. While many people are troubled by the thought of dying, others are disturbed by a much more profound anxiety that we might die without having really begun to live. I have a good friend who's also on the board of directors for the Center for Executive Leadership. And his wife has a nephew who has gone to work. He's a young man. And he describes him as a young lion. He has gone to work for one of the large international consulting firms that you're all familiar with. And he says he has a group of friends who they started together, and now they're spread out all over the country, maybe all over the world. And they have and I'm not real familiar with all this, they have a blog site where they all go and post emails and where they can read about what's going on in each of their lives. And anybody can go to these sites. And these guys are really talented, really successful, really young. And my friend went to the site and read where one of these young men wrote down questions on the road. And he says, when I travel, I am at one with my thoughts and my soul. Sadly, it's the only time I am truly myself, 100% disconnected from the stress and pressure which I have created in my life. It's on the road that I find myself asking the tough questions of life in search of answers to these questions. I decided to post this blog. I look forward to hearing and perhaps sharing you stories of enlightenment. This young man in his early 30s has left the consulting firm and is heads up one of GE's largest divisions in Chicago. Early 30s. My friend sent him a little response, which I won't read to you, but listen to what the guy replied. This is an email that's about 3 days old. "Recently, I have found myself questioning my life and purpose. Has my life had any impact? What have I really accomplished? What is the next step? How does my life work into the greater good? As I talk with my peers, I find that they too are asking themselves similar questions. I find it interesting that most outsiders would view my peers and I as successful. We all have good jobs. We make above average salaries." And then he says, "And we give the perception of strength and happiness. But there's clearly something missing in our lives. I fear that many of us will spend our entire lives looking for it, and in the end, never find it. We are all in search of something. What are you looking for? Me? Well, I wish I had an answer for you, but I do not." You know, as we begin this morning, you know, what is your experience? You know, does this resonate with you at all? And I realize we have a vast spectrum of men as far as ages and experiences, but we're all men. We're all in this together. And I think that this is a question we should all stop from time to time and ask. I need to tell you that the genesis of this talk came from a book that I read. And the book's really not that important, though it was quite good. It was by a guy by the name of Brian Mahan. But in the book, he makes some comments about one of Tolstoy's shorter novels. And I was intrigued by his comments to the point that I went out and bought the novel and read it last month. And the name of this particular work is The Death of Ivan Ilyich. And it's quite a fascinating story. It's not real long. But it's the story of this man, a successful lawyer and judge who lived in Tsarist Russia in the middle of the 19th century. Now, what happens to him is at the age of 45, at the peak of his career, he learns that he's dying. And so much of this book are his inner thoughts about his life and impending death. And he consistently finds himself asking this question, as he's very introspective. What has my life been all about? And what is it that I really want? And as he wrestles with these questions, he begins to recognize that the life he built for himself was a lie. Because he realized, like most of us, like most men, he had bought into the social script of the culture. And though he was married and he had children, though his marriage was rather lousy, his life ultimately had been consumed by three pursuits. Now, you have to remember, this was written 150 years ago. But the three pursuits were achievement, career achievement, prestige. He loved being a judge. He loved the power. He loved the recognition. Material wealth. He'd just gotten this new position. He'd moved his family to this new town. And they were able to buy a home in the wealthy section of town. And after he bought the home, he said this to himself, not out loud. He thought to himself, this home, in actuality, is like the houses of all people who are not really rich, but who want to look rich. And therefore, we end up all looking like one another. I find that interesting, 150 years ago, and how these same characteristics seem to reside in us today. And then he loved pleasure. He had his pleasures. He was a heavy drinker, and he was an occasional philanderer. But then he finds out he's dying. And what Tolstoy reveals through this story is how Ilyich's pursuits gave birth to confusion over what makes life really worthwhile and what it is that we each truly want. Listen to the words of this main character as he's soon to die and he's reflecting on his life, and this is what he says. It's as though I had been going steadily downhill in my inner life while I imagined I was going up. In public opinion, I was moving uphill, but at the same extent, my life was slipping away from me. In other words, he was saying outwardly, I was looking good. I was looking great. I was moving up. But my inner life, my soul, was becoming more and more corrupt. And Mahan, the guy that introduced me to this novel, he believes, and I agree with him, that Tolstoy was intentionally pressing this question on us, the reader. Why didn't this man know what he really wanted? And why don't we? You know, if you think about it, like I said, this novel was written 150 years ago, and yet it doesn't seem that we as men have changed a great deal. We seem to be driven by the same pursuits as this fictional character. And I think this was part of Tolstoy's genius, his ability to glimpse into the human soul, into the human motivation, and understand it. And what's ironic, about 3 or 4 months ago, before I'd even read the book, I told a guy that what I observe in most men's lives is after they're married and been married for a while and their kids are growing up and are kind of becoming more and more independent, we seem to lock in on three pursuits. And those three pursuits are the same pursuits that Ilyich was after, that Tolstoy recognized was true of men who lived in the 19th century. Achievement, performance, prestige, material wealth, and our pleasures. Now, if you've been coming to these breakfasts, we've been meeting here almost 4 years, you know that I have extensively examined each one of these in different venues, in different messages. And if you have any interest in any of those topics that I've just mentioned, just put it on a card. I'd be interested in getting one of those CDs and we'll send it to you, because I'm not going to extensively go into it, but I want to make a couple of maybe quick points to give some maybe new insights that I think is quite interesting. I read a story by Philip Yancey, and I want to share this with you real quick, particularly since we've just come out of March Madness. He says, each year in the spring, I fall victim to what the sports announcers diagnose as March Madness. I cannot resist the temptation to tune in to the final basketball game in which the sole survivors of a 64-team tournament meet for the NCAA championship. The most important game always seems to come down to one 18-year-old kid standing on a free throw line with 1 second left on the clock. He dribbles nervously. If he misses these two foul shots, he knows he will be the goat of his campus, the goat of his state. 20 years from now, he'll be in counseling, reliving that moment. If he makes these shots, but he'll be a hero. His picture will be on the front page. He could probably run for governor. He takes another dribble, and the other team calls timeout to rattle him. He stands on the sideline, weighing his entire future. Everything depends on him. His teammates pat him encouragingly, but say nothing. One year, I remember, I left the room to answer a phone call just as the kid was setting himself to shoot. Worry lines creased his forehead. He was biting his lower lip. His left leg quivered at the knee. 20,000 fans were yelling, waving banners and handkerchiefs to distract him. But the phone call took longer than expected. When I returned, I saw a new sight. This same kid, his hair drenched with Gatorade, was now riding atop the shoulders of his teammates, cutting the cords of a basketball net. He had not a care in the world. His grin filled the entire screen. And then Yancey said, you know, it was these two freeze frames, the kid crouching at the free throw line and then celebrating on his teammate's shoulders. He said, that came to symbolize for him the way our culture operates. It came to, he said, our world seems to measure people's lives strictly on how they perform. And then Yancey says, you know, if you think about it, in our culture, you've got to make the shot. You've got to make the shot if your life is going to measure up. And then he asked the question, but what happens if you miss it? What happens if you miss it? Stephen Covey honed in on this himself when he says, if we are performance-driven people, we, in effect, empower the opinion of others to guide and control us. And then he says this powerful statement, we gear our lives to meet the expectation of others. I want to read that again. We gear our lives to meet the expectation of others. You know, I don't know about you, but that is a scary thought. It's frightening that you and I might empower other people and let their opinions guide and shape the way we're going to live our lives. In fact, the way we do live our lives. I don't know how many of you know Henry Nouwen. He died in 1996. He was a Catholic priest. He taught at Yale and Harvard Divinity School. And then, the last 10 years of his life, he left the limelight. He wrote over 40 books. But he left the limelight and lived in obscurity, working in an institution where people with developmental disabilities lived. And he wrote a fantastic book on leadership. It was geared towards church leadership, but the principles that he talks about are universal. And then I'm going to read to you a summary of one of his chapters. He said something that's quite indicting for us as men. He says, what is it that makes the temptation of power, prestige, and high position so seemingly irresistible? Maybe it's because it offers an easy substitute for the hard task of love. It seems easier to be God than to love God. Easier to control people than to love people. Easier to own life than to love life. We see this even in Jesus' own disciples when it's asked, can we sit at your right hand and your left hand in your kingdom? The long, painful history of the world is for people to be tempted to choose prestige and power over love, being in charge over being led, being served over serving. And then he says this, one thing is clear to me, the temptation of power is greatest when intimacy is a threat. Often those who achieve and are in high positions do not know how to develop healthy, intimate relationships and have opted for power and control instead. Many empire builders have been people unable to give and receive love. You know what he's saying is, guys, you know, we may be successful, you know, but how well do we love? I think this explains why so many men struggle with intimacy. We can't be vulnerable. We refuse to let down our guard. For in no way do we want to reveal any weakness. And in the process, nobody really ever knows us. What about money and material possessions? One quick comment. One of my favorite teachers is a guy by the name of Dr. Tim Keller. And he's a Presbyterian minister in New York City. And supposedly, I don't know if this is a fact, but supposedly he has the largest church in the city. But what's interesting, and I can't remember, it's either a half or a third or maybe even two-thirds, but I think it's a half of his congregation are single professionals. Most of them work on Wall Street. And Keller said, in all his years of being in New York, you know, he has had hundreds of men come to see him to discuss their troubles, their issues, their problems. But he said, in all of my years, I have never had anyone come to me and say, I struggle with greed. I struggle with the love for money. I'm consumed with money and it's engulfed my life. He says, no one has ever said that to me. He says, they'll come to me. They'll share their marriage struggles. They'll talk about their sex life. They'll talk about their problem with pornography. They'll talk about their addictions. But they will not ever talk about the issue of money. Which makes me think, you know, you remember C.S. Lewis said about pride. You know, I can look out and you and I, we can see pride in men's lives. You know, we spend a lot of time together. We could look around, we'd see pride in each other. The problem, Lewis says, is we just can't see it in ourselves. And I think that's true maybe of greed and conspicuous consumption. You know, we can point our fingers at men all the time and say, look how they flash their money around. Look the way how they try to impress. And yet when we exhibit that same behavior, we're blind to it. And Keller says, what this reminds me of is a statement made centuries ago by a Roman citizen. And he made this, it was in an old letter that was discovered by a guy by the name of Dionysius. And he made this observation about the Christians in Rome, how strange they were. He said, you know, the Christians in Rome, they share their table with all, but not their bed with all. And he was saying this because this was in sharp contrast to the Roman Empire that was sliding into decadence. Because in Rome, sexuality was no longer sacred. They would share their bed with anybody. But what Dionysius was saying is, money to the Romans was what was sacred. And he said, and here you have these Christians. They're generous with their financial resources. And their sexuality is what is really sacred to them. You know, it makes me wonder where we are today as a nation. Now, just one quick word about pleasure. You know, I think so often many people think that Christianity condemns pleasure. And yet in reality, pleasure, if you really understand it, is a gift of God, and it brings great delight to our lives when it's enjoyed within the boundaries that God has given us. And I think everybody in this room would agree that pleasure without boundaries, where nothing in life is forbidden, will destroy you. I mean, even the decadent and interesting, I shouldn't call him decadent because I don't really know, but he made this observation. The behaviorist B.F. Skinner, Harvard psychologist, he even said there should be boundaries. His philosophy of life was, he said, the object of life is to gratify yourself without getting arrested. Now, if you think about it, what he's saying is, yes, you should have boundaries. Push the envelope as far as pleasure goes. Just make sure you don't get thrown in jail. In all seriousness, pleasure can bring great delight to the body and to the mind and to the emotions. But it's crucial to know it is powerless to satisfy the hunger of the soul. Another person I love to quote is Dallas Willard. He wrote a wonderful book called Renovation of the Heart. He was head of the philosophy department for years. I think he's retired at the University of Southern California. A brilliant man. And he says that when we attempt to satisfy our innermost being with the pleasures of life, he says what happens over time, it leads to a deadness of the soul. And he said he believes that modern people today are desperately fighting to keep deadness out of their souls. And he discusses this in this book, Renovation of the Heart, and it's interesting who he uses as his example. Or as an example, Tolstoy. He says Tolstoy had everything his heart desired. Fame, wealth, pleasure, social status. And in his book called Confessions, he says this, I quote, eventually my life came to a standstill. I could breathe, eat, drink, sleep. I couldn't help doing these things. But there was no life in me. For there were no wishes, the fulfillment of which I could consider reasonable. Had a fairy come and offered to fulfill my wishes, I would not have known what to ask for. I had everything, but my life is so pointless. Guys, do we really know what we want? You know, I think part of our problem is discussed or described by Pascal. Again, we go back into the past, 350 years ago. But this is profound and so on target. He said, we scarcely ever think of the present. And if we think of it, it's only to take light from it to arrange our future. We don't live in the present as we should. We live in the future. Consequently, he says, so we never really live. But we hope to live one day. We're always preparing for a full and satisfying life, but it is inevitable we'll all never find it. Do you hear what he's saying? And I think this is so true. He says, life for most of us is what happens while we're planning the future. You know, once I graduate from college, once I get married, once I get the kids out of the house, once I retire, he says, this is the way we live our lives. Because we think, once this happens in the future, then my life will be good. Then my life will be full. Then my life will be satisfying. He says, but it never happens. We go to our deathbeds thinking, once this happens. I don't know why this dawned on me this morning when I got up, that this also explains a lot about depression. I would think in a group this size, you know, almost 300 men, that there are some in here who suffer from depression from time to time. And I meet with men who struggle with depression. Not that I'm qualified, they just come and talk. And it strikes me, this is the way they live. They can't live in the now, in the present. They're always pointing to the future and how hopeless it is. And therefore they live with despair. Maybe this is why Jesus says we should live each day, one day at a time. There's a lot of wisdom in that. Let me take this a step further. What do you think would happen to your life, to your life experience, if you were able to get everything you wanted, everything your heart desired? You know, some people do. Some people get everything they want in life. And we usually envy them and wonder why them and not me. And yet it's interesting. I think the nation was stunned last year when Mel Gibson, on national TV, talking to Diane Sawyer, says at the peak of his career, he contemplated suicide. The peak of his career, he contemplated suicide. And then he went on to say, this is what led him back to the faith of his childhood, to his Catholicism. It's interesting. Matt Damon said something very similar in Parade magazine several years ago. I read this, the words of Boris Becker. He'd won his second Wimbledon. He said, I had won Wimbledon twice before, once as the youngest player ever. I was rich. I had all the material possessions I needed, money, cars, women, everything. I know that this is a cliche. It's the old song of the movie and pop stars who commit suicide. They have everything, and yet they are so unhappy. I had no inner peace. I was a puppet on a string. And he says, I came very close to taking my life. I love what the best-selling novelist, Jack Higgins, said. He was asked, based on what you know now, what do you wish you had known when you were 16? A very successful man. He said this, I wish someone had told me that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. And then I have to come back to Tolstoy. Because Tolstoy, at the height of his literary career, admitted this in his book, that when working in his study, while writing, he had to hide away a rope that was there for fear he would use it on himself. But what's interesting about Tolstoy, what turned it around for him, was that in the village in which he lived, there were a number of Christian peasants, and he was intrigued by the fact that they were so content. And he, this is what he said, they were so content, and they knew the meaning of life and death. And he said they were truly unlike the educated aristocratic friends that he hung out with, who he says were horrified by the prospect of dying because they saw no point to life other than living it. You know, now as we sit here this morning, I'm sure that some of us are thinking that if I could attain all of my dreams, if I could get everything I wanted in life, my life would be good. I mean, it would be real good. And yet, interesting, Dallas Willard, in an interview, shares a wonderful little story as we think about that. And it's a true story. He says, one of my favorite stories is about the dog races in Florida. They train these dogs to chase an electric rabbit. And one night, the rabbit broke down, and the dogs caught it. He said, but they didn't know what to do with it. They were just leaping around, yelping and biting one another, totally confused about what was happening. I think that's a picture of what happens to all sorts of people who catch the rabbit in their life. Whether it's wealth or fame or beauty or a bigger house or whatever, the prize isn't what they thought it would be. And when they finally get it, they don't know what to do with their lives. And he says, this is a huge factor in why men finish their lives so badly. And then he says, we need our lives tied to something that transcends the individual life. You think about what is Willard saying? He is saying, nothing finite can satisfy this deep longing of the soul. Because, you know, that's the Bible uses the metaphor of what we're talking about as a hunger and thirst of the soul. Now, what happens generally over time is that many people, if they find an emptiness in their lives, think, well, I need some religion in my life. As if sitting in church for 1 hour once a week would do that. And don't get me wrong, I am pro-church. But I know, looking back on my life, it was a time where I had quit going to church. Life was good, but there was some nagging emptiness or something in my life. And my first thought was, I need some religion in my life. Just a little bit, but I need some religion in my life, and started going to church, but nothing happened. Because I think this is true. Maybe it's true for some of us here this morning. I find that to so many people, God is nothing more than a concept. And he's a concept that I try to fit into my life the way I want him to fit into my life. But he's not a living reality, which is what we need. You know, this is what we saw in 9/11. I don't know if you realize it, but right after 9/11, church attendance nationwide went up something like 20 to 25%. But 1 year later, it was back to its original level. Religion itself just doesn't do it. It's like the most religious people in the Bible were the Pharisees. And yet Jesus says they were spiritually dead. He says they were like whitewashed tombs. On the outside they looked good, but on the inside they were dead spiritually. So what I'd like to do right now is just take a few more minutes and try to pull all of this together and see if there's any kind of application we can take home. And I want to start by reading you some remarks by Anthony Campolo. I don't know if you know Campolo. He's quite a controversial figure. I like him. A lot of conservatives really criticized him because he was kind of Bill Clinton's mentor when he was going through his troubles in the White House. But listen to what Campolo says. He teaches college at Eastern College in Philadelphia. And it's interesting. He says every year about this time, early May, he says, I'll have a couple of students. And this is, I thought this was interesting. He says, and they're always male. He says, you never have any females come. He says, they always come and they say, Doctor, I'm not coming back next semester. And Campolo always says, I try to look concerned. And he says, what's the matter? They say, I need time. I need time to find myself. I need to figure out who I am and what my life is really all about. And Campolo says, there's a whole generation of students out there trying to find themselves, and they're all looking in the same place, Colorado. He says, they come and they say, I'm tired of playing the roles that others have prescribed for me. I'm tired of being the person my family expects to me. I want to find out who I really am in my innermost being. And so I'm going to search and find myself. And Campolo always tries to make light of it and says, well, what if you get to your innermost being and you find that there's nothing there? And then he makes this statement. And this is at the heart, really, of what I want to try to maybe get across. These are his words. I am convinced that the self is not an essence waiting to be discovered through philosophical introspection. Quite the contrary, I believe that the self is an essence waiting to be created. We create who we are, listen to this, through the commitments that we make in this life. And without commitments, we have no identity. That's why Jesus said, whoever seeks to find himself will lose himself. But whosoever is willing to lose himself for my sake and the sake of my kingdom will find himself. Jesus is telling us that it is in commitments to him and the work that he has for us to do that we discover who we are and what our lives are all about. In other words, he's saying our lives are shaped by the commitments we make. There is a power in a committed life. And furthermore, Rabbi Zacharias says that the commitment of love is at the heart of a meaningful life. Now, before I go further, I want to share this with you. I've been meeting with a guy going through the investigative study with him. It's been fascinating. A very, very well-educated, very bright, very wise guy. Has a great career. And we were talking the other day, he made this comment. He said, you know, the problem I notice with men, my peers, the professionals that I do business with, he says, men hate making commitments. They love options. They love for life to be one big option. The more the better. They want to live a flexible existence. They want to be autonomous. But then he said this. What they don't realize, it leads to confusion, particularly of who they are. You know, if you think about it, if you commit to something, it means you have to give up something. I mean, you could take, I could say I'm going to be committed to becoming a scratch golfer. Now, for me in my golf game, that would require me to give up quite a bit just to get there. I mean, I'd probably have to give up my job if I was going to be a scratch golfer. It would take that kind of commitment. But if you're going to truly commit to a love relationship, you have to give up yourself. Now, I say that with the knowledge, I think, in this room, that the commitment each of us is most aware of in life is the marriage commitments we make. You know, you think about it, when we choose to get married, you're talking about giving up autonomy. You're giving up almost everything. You think about what you do when you get married. Next time you go to a wedding, listen to the vows. You're giving all that you are and all that you have to this person. It's kind of interesting. My wife and I are very soon getting ready to celebrate our 10th anniversary. But just to kind of let you know just about our last 10 years, on our 5th anniversary, and you got to remember, I was 41 when I got married. I'd lived by myself for almost 20 years. On our 5th anniversary, not only did I have a wife, I had a 3.5-year-old, a 2-year-old, and an 8-month-old. And so to say that our lives have been a little bumpy in the last 10 years would be an understatement. But I want to tell you this. This past year has been by far the best year in our marriage, and it may be the best year in my life. I mean, it's hard to gauge those things. But my wife and I were having dinner the other night, and we were talking about this very thing. And what we both concluded and what we both agree upon is that when we each put ourselves aside in our dealings with each other, when we die to what we want and we put the other person ahead of ourselves, what we have discovered, our marriage flourishes. The love that we have for each other grows and deepens. You see, what I'm saying is when we give up our lives, we gain what we're really looking for in our marriage. Think about that. By giving up, we gain. Hopefully you can see that this is a very powerful and yet paradoxical principle. And I would articulate it simply by being, if you really want to live, if you want to find real life, you have to give up your life. And that is so foreign to our thinking. Author Elizabeth Elliot, I think, gives a good description of this when she says, "The growth of all living green things wonderfully represents the process of receiving and relinquishing, gaining and losing, living and dying. The seed falls into the ground and dies as the new shoot springs up. There must be a splitting and a breaking in order for a bud to form. The bud lets go when the flower forms. The calyx lets go of the flower. The petals must curl up and die in order for the fruit to form. The fruit then falls, splits, relinquishes the seed. The seed falls into the ground, and the process keeps going." She says there is no ongoing spiritual life without this process of letting go. At the precise point where we refuse, growth stops. If we hold tightly to anything given to us, unwilling to let go when the time comes to let it go, or unwilling to allow it to be used as the giver means it to be used, we stunt the growth of the soul. And then she says, think of your life as an acorn. It's a marvelous little thing, a perfect shape, perfectly designed for its purpose, perfectly functional. It goes into the ground and it dies. And she says, think of the grand glory of an oak tree. When you look at the oak tree, you don't feel that the loss of the acorn is a very great loss. Philip Yancey shares that in his career as a journalist, this is interesting, he says, "I have interviewed diverse people, and looking back, I can roughly divide them into two types, stars and servants. The stars include NFL greats, movie actors, music performers, famous authors, TV personalities, and the like. These are the people who dominate our magazines and our television programs. We fawn over them, poring over the minutiae of their lives, the clothes they wear, the food they eat, the aerobic routines they follow, the people they love, the toothpaste they use. Yet I must tell you that in my limited experience, these idols are as miserable a group of people as I have ever met. Most have trouble or broken marriages. Nearly all are hopelessly dependent on psychotherapy. In a heavy irony, these larger-than-life heroes seem tormented by incurable self-doubt. He says, I have spent time with servants. Then he gives some examples. One of them is a guy, Dr. Paul Brand, one of the greatest hand surgeons in the world, who gave up his practice to go and work with people who suffered from leprosy in India, and then he ended up in Louisiana here in the United States. He says, as I look at all of these servants, I was prepared to honor and admire them, to hold them up as inspiring examples for us all. He said, but I was not, however, prepared to envy them. But as I now reflect on the two groups side by side, stars and servants, the servants clearly emerge as the favored ones. They found real life. And he says, somehow in the process of losing their lives, they found them. Now, I find this happens sometimes. You may be asking, Richard, are you telling me that I should quit my career, sell everything I have, and go work with the poor? You know, if that's what you hear me saying, then you're completely missing what I'm trying to communicate. What I'm trying to point out is a spiritual truth that can radically change each of our lives. And I truly believe it's the key to finding a full, satisfying life, a life that is coherent. I think this is the heart of the Christian message as well. As I close, I have three illustrations that I want to leave you with, and we'll be done. Go back to marriage. This past fall, I had a unique experience. My nephew asked me to participate in his wedding. I'm not ordained. I couldn't marry him. He asked me to do the welcome and give a little sermon. But I had no idea how to welcome people at a wedding. And I wasn't sure even where to find a traditional wedding ceremony. So I went back to the 1928 Book of Common Prayer that's used in the Episcopal Church. And I looked up the wedding ceremony, and this is what I used. Listen to it. Dearly beloved, we are gathered together here in the sight of God and these witnesses to join together this man and this woman in holy matrimony, which is an honorable estate instituted of God. And then this next statement really rocked me. It just like, I mean, I probably have heard it 100 times, but it was like a light came on. And he's talking about marriage, signifying unto us the mystical union that is between Christ and his church. What this is saying is that marriage is a picture of what our relationship with God should be like. You know, if you know the Gospels, Jesus continually refers to himself as the bridegroom and his people as the bride. Think about that language that he uses. It's the language of marriage, where two people enter into a holy, binding relationship. You know, the Scripture tells us this. There are only two holy, binding relationships in this life. Your relationship with your spouse and your relationship with your God. And both of them must be chosen freely, and both must be entered into with a heart that is deeply prepared to be committed. And if these relationships and our lives are to flourish, we have to give up our lives, which doesn't come natural. In Matthew 16:25, Jesus says, the man who loses his life for my sake will find it. And ironically, you know what the next verse is? Verse 26. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Do you realize what Christ is saying? What happens if you get everything you want in life and yet in the process you forfeit your soul? Three years ago, I was in Atlanta for a conference. And one of the speakers was a guy, he was about my age. He was the former president of Saab in North America, the car company. And he jet-set it all over the world. And he began to wrestle with his life and what was important. And he shared a great story that changed his life. He and his wife adopted a two, maybe three-year-old child from the Soviet Union. And this little girl, who obviously spoke no English, had lived in an orphanage. And she was malnourished. You know, there were hundreds of little girls. And they brought her, they adopted her, they brought her into their home. And he said the first day there, she was there because of the way she had, the malnutrition in her life, they had to give her simple food. And the first thing they gave her were just dry Cheerios. And he said she consumed them. She loved them. And he said when she was about finished with the meal, she would take the last little part and she'd put them in her hand. And she'd hold them tightly in her hand all day long. She'd never let go of those Cheerios. They gave her a bath that first night, never let go. Finally, when she went to sleep, she relinquished them, and they took them out of her hand. Same thing happened the second day, and then the third day. And he said, that night, we were giving her a bath again, and I was really frustrated. And he said, I started to pry her little fingers loose from those Cheerios, and she wouldn't budge. And he said, I thought to myself, why won't you let go of those Cheerios? I have so much more I want to give you than just Cheerios. And he said, in a flash, he realized this is what God had been trying to say to him. Let go of your life. Give up those Cheerios. Because I have so much more that I want to give you. Let go of your life. Let go of your agenda. Because there's so much that I want to pour into your life. Finally, the last point comes from, I think, if it's not the shortest, it's one of the shortest parables, two sentences in the Bible. But it brings all of this together. Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went out and sold all that he had and he bought it. You know, this parable is so pertinent to what we've been talking about this morning. Because Christ is telling us, this merchant's search for pearls represents the long human search for satisfaction and meaning. This pearl merchant obviously possessed already certain pearls, which were probably of great value to him, just as our lives are such great value to us. And yet he was still searching. He was searching for something which he didn't possess, but he was hoping might be out there somewhere. And when he finds this pearl of great value, he gladly sells everything. Everything that he had previously he considered very worthwhile. He sells everything in order to take hold of this pearl of great value. And so, men, this morning, I think Jesus is telling us very clearly that this is what a new and right relationship with God is worth. It's worth everything. He's saying to us, I am what your heart is really longing for, but you must give yourself to me. You must surrender your life to me. You must let go. Because he says, when we do, we will suddenly find that we have everything we've been searching for. Let us pray. Father, we acknowledge that so often we really don't know what we want. That we're confused. Yet we don't want anybody to know about it. Father, we acknowledge that we all need that pearl of great value. Father, help us to relinquish. Help us to let go. Help us to surrender our lives to you. That as we give up our lives to you, that we might find our lives. And that might be the prayer in the hearts of some men this morning. Lord, I let go. I surrender. Come into my life. Fill me. We thank you for our time together. We thank you for the lives you've given us, for our families. And we do thank you for that pearl of great value, which we all long for. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.